Recently, I visited one of my hospice patients, was lying in his hospital bed, agitated and red-eyed from allergies that he was having, and probably also because he had been watching a news channel straight for, just without turning it off, just constant din in his room. He could not walk, and food was felt appetizing or was tasteful to him. His wife was growing weary of his irritability and annoyed with his stubborn watching of things on television. And when I approached him and asked him how he's feeling, he said, as the television is blaring loud noise from the news, he says, "Well, I'd be doing better if these politicians would just stop being a bunch of crooks." And I just couldn't help but wonder if his irritability and his restlessness, at least partly, was due to the noise about leaders who are thieves and bandits. And when I challenged the patient about watching something else, something that would bring him greater peace in his life, bring him less distress about the condition of the world, he said to me, "Well, it's important that we stay informed." And I thought, why? What do we gain from all of this information? How do we benefit from all of this noise? I thought about this patient this week as I reflected on the passage that I just read earlier, the one about this sheepfold and the shepherd, the bandits who try to enter the sheepfold another way, the gate, the good shepherd who leads the sheep out to pasture. The sheepfold Jesus is speaking about is set in a far drier landscape than the ones that we actually picture when we think about a nice idyllic sheepfold with cute cuddly sheep bouncing on green turf. The shepherds that Jesus was picturing were nomadic, and they often went far away from the towns and the villages in search of green pastures that are mentioned in Psalm 23 that was read earlier. And these green pastures, I should put that in quote, because they were really scrubby hillsides with clumps of vegetation just pressing out from underneath the rocks. And then, as the day came to a close, the shepherd would go around and would pick up the rocks that are that were just easily accessible to him, and he would begin constructing this enclosure. And it would have been circular, and it would have been made from, from these stones in the area. It would have been probably about 2 to 3 feet high, and that would have been a high one. And sometimes, if there was available, he might top it all off with thorns, kind of like an ancient day barbed wire for the top to keep the wolves out. This is the sheepfold that Jesus was talking about. And this one that Jesus is talking about today, it's pretty noisy and pretty raucous. In this sheepfold, there are sheep thieves and bandits surrounding it. We find that out later, too, that there are snarling wolves there as well. It is a teeming sheepfold that serves as like this metaphor for us to describe the tension the audience was feeling as they considered following Jesus or following the religious leaders of that time. Recently, I was reading through some letters that were written by my grandfather to my grandmother during World War II. And he was telling, and this is before he got shipped off to the Pacific, and I noticed that in several of these letters, he was mentioning a gift that he was giving to families that had been kind to him while he was in basic training. And he was like, he was mentioning it kind of like it was like the hot gift item of the time. Like everyone would want this. And he mentions it over and over again. And he called it Solomon's Head of Christ. And admittedly, I didn't know what it was. And so I Googled it, and I'm sure many of you are doing it right now. What the heck? Let's all Google it right now, because I know you're going to do it during the service. But Solomon's Head of Christ, S-A-L-L-M-A-N, apostrophe S, Solomon's Head of Christ. And when you see it, you're probably going to say, "Oh, I've seen that before. during the middle of the 20th century, and even today, this painting would be found everywhere, from Sunday school rooms, church chancels, and even if you didn't go to church, you'd probably recognize it because it shows up just everywhere. Some have called it the most reproduced piece of art from the 20th century. And the artist, Walter Salmon, didn't stop with his portrait. Because if you look at those paintings from Walter Salmon, you're like, oh, I think I know that one and that one. I've seen that one too. I've seen that one. There's Christ knocking on the door. There's Christ in Gethsemane. And yes, there is Christ the Good Shepherd. I can picture each one of these paintings right now without even looking at them. And because they were just so popular, they shaped our perception of Jesus today even, possibly more than any other work of art, for better, but mostly for worse. Solomon's portraits of Jesus cemented him as a 20th century icon with this strong jaw, hair that made people in the 40s okay with long hair on a guy. He was steely-eyed, and he was magnificently tanned, and he was a tanned white shepherd. It shows us what we as a society valued back then, and maybe even as a savior one today, one who is handsome and tall and slender and athletic, but also tender and determined, one who was so in control of himself, even his long hair looked well-coiffed. One who is non-threatening, one who is approachable, and again, white. Centuries earlier, the most popular images that we found, I mean, back in from the first century, most popular images of Jesus were found not hanging in public buildings like Solomon's head of Christ here. They were found in underground secret places of worship that we called the catacombs. They were burial grounds. And the most common depiction of Jesus in that first century, those first century catacombs, was of Jesus as the shepherd, a rugged laborer wearing a short robe and boots and a lamb slung over his shoulder. And those images also tell us something about what the people back in the day really truly valued when it came to their leaders. What they valued were the qualities that could be seen in a shepherd. The fact of that they were a leader who braved the wild animals and the rival bandits to lead their sheep along ancient paths in the scrubby desert landscapes. But it wasn't just the early church that valued the qualities of a shepherd. Many ancient Middle East cultures during that time also valued the shepherd culture. In fact, we can look at, we see in the Old Testament, we see prophets like Amos and leaders like Joseph and Moses and kings like David all got their start as shepherds. We even find ancient art depicting pharaohs and kings of Mesopotamia holding shepherd's crooks, because they valued the leadership characteristics that were found in shepherds. The popularity of these images centuries ago, and even in the 20th century today, show us that we all really still want leaders that look like shepherds, but good shepherds nonetheless. But so often I think what happens is that we end up getting bandits who expertly impersonate the look and the feel of shepherds. One of the ancient prophets of the Old Testament wrote this in Ezekiel 34. He said, "Woe to you shepherds of Israel who only take care of yourselves. Should not shepherds take care of the flock? You have not strengthened the weak. You have not healed the sick or bound up the injured. You have not brought back the strays or searched for the lost. You have ruled them harshly and brutally." Can't you hear this echoed, I think, in what Jesus was talking about before when he says that the thieves come to steal and kill and destroy? Jesus is comparing, he's contrasting shepherds, thieves, and bandits as if to say, you religious and cultural leaders, you have neglected your responsibilities. You are nothing but a bunch of crooks. You can understand why Jesus is so angry and annoyed here when you read the passage that comes before this. See, right before this, Jesus has healed the blind man in the temple. Heals the blind man using saliva and dirt in the ground. He makes mud, puts it on his eyes. The man, all of a sudden, he tells him to go wash in the pool. The man washes his eyes, comes out. He can see. And so he goes looking everywhere for Jesus to see where Jesus is, to thank him, and the religious leaders catch wind of what has taken place. And they call into question that Jesus has healed someone on the Sabbath. So they call Jesus a sinner, and they criticize and they question the man. They interrogate him. And when they don't like his responses, well, they kick him out. They send him out, send him away. And that's what happens right before. Jesus says, anyone who enters the sheepfold by another way, other than the gate, is a thief and a bandit. Those leaders do not have the right intentions. They are leading you to destruction. Jesus here is about as subtle as a poke in the eye. These leaders use their power to exploit, to kill, to steal, to destroy. They aren't shepherds who are committed to leading the sheep. They're not committed to leading the sheep to pasture. They are crooks who create noise, who exploit, who exclude. And like many of our leaders and influencers today, oh, they're killing, they're destroying, and they do so claiming to be shepherds. They woo us with dangerous promises of abundance and security, and they persuade us all to just trust them. But that's, I think, what's more dangerous, though, from their words alone, is that what is happening to me. And that is what I'm finding is that I am becoming increasingly fascinated and interested in the words and the work of leaders who are bent on killing and stealing and destroying. I really am. I'm really ashamed to say it too to you today. But I think I'm more, this is what I think is true. I believe that I am more aware and more acquainted with the voices and the activity of the thieving, cowardly leaders than I am with the voice of the shepherd. The danger for sheep like you and me today is that we are focusing on the bandits at the perimeter and the thieves who use creative ways to draw our attention and earn our loyalty. The danger for the sheep like you and me is not that we hear the shepherd through the, it's not that we can't hear the shepherd, it's the fact that we can't hear the shepherd through the noise. We can hear it. We just can't separate it. We can't prioritize it. And so, Jesus helps us find his voice in the noise. He reassures them, he reassures his audience, he says, you know my voice, you know it, you really do. I know you think you don't, but you do. And he grounds it in welcome and in acceptance. It's a voice that tells us to not be afraid. It's a voice that tells us, that calls us forward. It doesn't call us to look back, it calls us forward. It tells us to follow in the footsteps of one who intends to lead us to goodness. To follow goodness and mercy, as was said before, right? Not wealth and power. There's a big difference. Jesus calls us to abundance, not again this abundance accumulation of wealth and riches, abundance that is shalom, contentedness to be in a right relationship with others and with ourselves. If we follow his voice, Jesus says that we will run from all the other voices because we know how destructive they can be, and that while they may be enticing, they do not lead us to pasture, to the true abundance that Jesus talks about. Instead, we look to the shepherd who is also the gate, which is a little bit confusing, admittedly, why he says, because Jesus just said he was the shepherd, and he's almost like he's a little bit frustrated with his crowd, with the audience, because they don't get it, and he says, look, I am the gate. I'm the gate. And so I can, again, perceive the audience being a little bit confused by this. What is the gate, really? Because for us, we think about a gate that's like a piece of wood that is connected to a fence and it swings open that way, right? But a gate back in the, with this rugged sheepfold, trust me, the shepherds didn't spend time working on their carpentry skills, bringing a nice gate on hinges to swing open and wide. A gate was simply a space in between the wall. It was a gap there. And so who stood in the way of the way in that little gap in the evening or at night when all the sheep were in the pen or in the sheepfold? It was the shepherd. So the shepherd stands in the gap and basically says, "I am the gate. I am the door. I am the place that's going to fill in the gap." When I was in college, I worked at a small farmette for the summer, which was a little bit like being a sexton, except it was working outside with sheep and all that kind of stuff. It wasn't like, actually, it wasn't like we're being a sexton at all, I have to admit. But anyway, I worked as this farmette for a summer, and it was my job to paint the house, which I did a pretty poor job at. But anyway, I painted the house, and I did several other activities around the farmette, tending to the miniature goats and to the chickens and to the five sheep of the farm. I know some of you are smiling about this, trying to picture me doing this, but that's okay. The owner of the farmette, too, he was a rugged contractor whom his wife called him Big Paul. And his son, she would call him Little Paul. But Little Paul was actually a very big man. He was a former offensive lineman for the University of Illinois who weighed about 330 pounds and he was about 6'5". Well, one day we were outside trying to make some adjustments to the sheepfold, this area for all the sheep, these big sheep that they have there. And the matriarch of the sheep, which was really quite imposing, was stubborn and she was just massive and had a very strong head on her shoulders. And I remember she wanted to kind of head out to the pasture and bring the other sheep with her. But Little Paul stood in her way. And I remember watching this stubborn sheep fake one way and then darted for the gap between Little Paul and I. And I will never forget Little Paul shifting to his right like an offensive guard picking up a blitzing linebacker. And he slapped both of his meat claws in the back of this sheep's thick woolly coat here, and he lifted it up so that it was rearing it like a horse, and then he threw it backwards so that it stumbled, and then it looked back at Paul and it stayed put. And I remember thinking when I saw that, that was awesome. What a display of power and strength. That is a shepherd, right? Someone who fills the gap, who protects and calls for our attention, who commands our respect. And yet, that image is incomplete according to the text we have for today. Because the shepherd isn't just about control or keeping you in your place. No, the shepherd is the gate that means opening up to a pasture and letting you into protection. The shepherd is the gap that welcomes sheep into the fold and then leads the sheep out into more abundance. And Jesus is not apologetic. He's not vague or open-ended about this. The message is strong and clear. I am the voice in the noise of the sheepfold of life. I deserve your attention. Sift out the static in your life and run from those bandits and pay attention to me. Follow me. Quite a few years ago, singer, songwriter, and storyteller Bill Harley shared on NPR's All Things Considered about experience he had watching his son's T-ball game. The team Bill's son played for often played another team who had a player by the name of Tracy. Tracy had several limitations, including hearing aids in both ears and Coke bottle glasses to help her see. In addition, she was painfully slow, running at a loping, carefree way with one leg pulling the other and an arm wildly windmilling in the air. Tracy, as you can imagine, was not good, but she loved to play. and her joy of life was just boundless and unflappable. No time was this joy more apparent than when Tracy came to bat. A ball would be placed on the tee, and Tracy would swing many times until finally she would whack the tee itself and the ball would fall harmlessly on the ground in front of it. And every time she did this, the people watching in the stands would shout to her, "Run, Tracy, run!" And Tracy would always be happy to please, and she would lope off to first, clutching the bat with both arms, smiling. And usually someone would pick up the ball, and they would track Tracy down, and they would tag her out. And everyone always applauded. Well, it came to the last game of the season, and Tracy came to bat. And during this one at bat, through some fluke or some miracle, Tracy swung and not only hit the ball, she smoked the ball right up the middle, through the legs of about 17 stunned players, all the way out into the outfield. But Tracy just stood there watching what happened, happy just to see what she had done. And so everyone in the stands, shocked what they had said, began to holler, "Run, Tracy, run!" And that's what her teammates said, "Run, Tracy, run!" And Tracy loped off to first, happy to please. At this point, the first players were just getting to the ball, and so the fans cried out to Tracy, "Run to second! Run, Tracy, run!" And so Tracy galloped off to second, happy to please. And at this point, the players were passing the ball to each other because in this T-ball league, every player must touch the ball. And so the parents and the fans cheered in one voice to Tracy, "Run to third base." And so Tracy, wondering why everyone was cheering so loud, happily windmill her way to third base. And the opposing team got at this point, everyone had touched the ball. And so Tracy was within striking distance, but one eager boy wildly threw the ball into the dugout, which caused absolute pandemonium at this point. The parents were falling out of the stands, exhorting her to home plate. Her sweaty, red-faced coach ran to home plate and was frantically gesturing for Tracy to come on home. And so Tracy began her loping to the plate and then stopped halfway between third and home. In the joyful chaos, no one had noticed an old geriatric mutt had come onto the field and lay down right there beside the line leading to home. No one noticed the mutt except for Tracy, who stopped to consider this dog. "Run, Tracy, run!" Everyone, the parents shrieked. Tracy looked at the coach. "Run, Tracy, run!" And she looked at her teammates, nearly passing out with excitement. "Run, Tracy, run!" And everything went in slow motion as Tracy stood there 30 feet from a home run. Tracy looked at the dog. Tracy looked at the fans. She looked at the dog. She looked at her coach. She looked at the dog. She looked at home. She went for the dog. And this is how Bill Harley tells it. It was a moment of complete stunned silence. And then, perhaps not as loud, but deeper, longer, more heartfelt, we all applauded as Tracy fell to her knees to hug the dog. Two roads diverged on a third base line, and Tracy went for the dog. I think each day we find ourselves in Tracy's position. Our roads diverge and we find ourselves in a sea of noise, people all over the place telling us which way to go and what we should do and who we should pay attention to. And we have to decide who will be the priority in those moments. We can choose to be lost in the noise of it all. We can choose to pay attention to thieves and bandit leaders, even if we say we're ignoring them and we really don't listen to them, or we're disgusted by them, or we're appalled by what they have to say. Or we can draw attention to the one who will accept us, the one who loves us, the one who protects us and comes lead us to abundant life.